I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with Rob Johnson, Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, and you can learn more at ineteconomics.org. That's I-N-E-T for Institute for New Economic Thinking, I-N-E-T economics, all one word, .org. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. When I anticipated that the presidential election might not be resolved by Thursday afternoon, when we would be recording this conversation, I emailed Rob Johnson, offering the possibility that we postpone till we knew who won and what administration we would be talking about. He very clearly declined, pointing out that our challenges as a nation both precede and go far beyond the election or re-election of Donald Trump. This is what I wrote before heading to bed election night. Biden may win, but it saddens and sickens me that this election can be close, and I feel the dread weight of the possibility of Trump still winning bearing down on me. Trump, the Republican Senate, and the Republican governors have for the most part proven unfit. The economy and any semblance of normality, such as kids going to school, depend on us getting the upper hand on the virus. Europe is showing that in the best of circumstances, that's hard to do. But there's nothing to suggest that Trump will be any more willing or able to take responsibility at the federal level for our national response. If you're not a member of the cult, if you're not someone willing to attend a super spreader rally, how do you vote for a guy who has failed so completely handling the virus relative to other countries and then says he plans to fire Fauci right after the election? We face some big challenges. Global health of humans and the rest of nature, climate change, nuclear war, gross inequality, and for the 4 years of Trump, we have ignored or aggravated most of them. And I find another 4 years almost unthinkable. We're going to go through some tough times, even just in terms of the pandemic and the economy, but add natural disasters, fires, police brutality, urban unrest. We need to come together to deal with both these existential crises and these tough times. And if he wins, Trump will continue to drive us apart. We cannot afford that. Thankfully for my mental health, so that's what I wrote election night. Thankfully for my mental health and every other reason you can think of, it appears Biden will pull this out. Still, there's a lot to talk about in terms of how we got here and how we move forward. Preparing for my first conversation with Rob Johnson back in 2011, I came across a quote. I think I found it on the website of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. And the quote was this: when the economic system breaks, it spares no one. But such a crisis can provide an opportunity to work together to create real, lasting change. This is one of those times, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to transform economics as we know it. Now, that quote was talking about the Great Recession of 2008-2009, but I think the pandemic and the shrunken, currently crippled, and ultimately changed economy offer the same once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Obama was elected to lead the nation and the economy out of the crash. Biden, if he triumphs, will be asked to lead the economy out of the pandemic. But Biden fails if the best he can do is deliver Obama 2.0. Under Obama, we didn't transform economics. Not only that, we didn't respond in any meaningful way to most who were hurt in the crash. Many of these people had felt left behind and hurt long before the crash, and enough of them turned out at the polls in the Rust Belt in 2016 to elect Donald Trump. In the UK Guardian today, a column by Owen Jones titled, "Even if Biden wins, the world will pay the price for the Democrats' failures," is a good setup for this conversation. I'm going to read you a couple of paragraphs, and then I'll turn to my conversation with Rob Johnson. In the aftermath of the financial crash, Obama's presidential campaign appeared to offer a break with the failures of successive Republican and Democratic administrations. But while he rescued the banks and let financial executives off the hook for their role in the 2008 crash, wages for millions of Americans stagnated or declined. While the slice of national income belonging to middle Americans fell from 62% to 43% between 1970 and 2018. The number of billionaires has surged from 66 in 1990, with a combined wealth of $240 billion, to 614 today, with a total fortune of nearly $3 trillion. And there have been many billionaires added since the pandemic really locked things down in March, and they have added, I think, about $1 trillion in that time to their fortunes. America is now a society in which one in every 11 black adults is either in prison or on parole or probation. Racial injustices that Black Lives Matter has urgently underlined. The Democratic establishment has proved itself politically bankrupt and unable to meet these challenges. The party lost against Trump in 2016 and has at best scraped a stillborn administration this time around. We will all pick up the tab for this failure. Rob Johnson has an interesting history. He's been a player among the elites who's also a plain-speaking and passionate critic of an economic, financial, and political system that leaves too many behind. He serves as director of the Project on Global Finance at the Roosevelt Institute and previously served as chief economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, was an executive producer of the Oscar-winning documentary Taxi to the Dark Side, was a management director at Soros Fund Management, and is now executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, which is funded by Soros to encourage and support a rethinking of the fundamentals of economics so that they take into account the role of human behavior, including politics. Welcome again, Rob Johnson, to Freeform, a world that just might work.
It's my pleasure to be here. I'm grateful you had me on.
Okay. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Thursday, November 5th. So first of all, Rob, how are you? How are you coping with the resurgent pandemic and the overtime election?
Well, there's, how would I say, I've got two young children in third and sixth grade, largely at home at school, becoming technological wizards, and I'm enjoying watching their evolution. The call to action that led to the formation of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, which I'll refer to as INET, is now even more urgent than ever. We're trying to figure out how to transform our mode of working, and that's got some interesting challenges in it. But mostly, what you invited me on to talk about, this relationship between society, politics, representation, and the notion of social and environmental sustainability, I find quite daunting. And the kind of symptoms that you described in your opening remarks suggest to me the task will be very formidable. With those young children, I feel a responsibility, not just to the ones that I've spawned, but to the whole generation, and how to impart profound change. Maybe this horridness is a gift. It's the silver lining. It's the higher spirits giving us a chance to make deep and powerful overdue changes that have been beckoning us for almost 40 years, but intensifying, as you described, with the increasing concentration of wealth and the neglect of broad-based prosperity by what's called a meritocracy.
This vision that you've just suggested, this vision that there might be a possibility in this breakdown. You'll notice in my intro, I mentioned two once-in-a-lifetime opportunities.
Yeah.
That's like Nowadays people have 100-year floods or 1,000-year floods every year. There's something just exaggerated about everything that's going on. But you must talk a lot with other folks about, is this an opportunity? So that notion that I hold and that you hold, that breakdown can be an opening for breakthrough. How do you find among your friends, colleagues, and so on, does it bring a nodding of heads, or are people think you're naive?
No, there's kind of, I mean, people want to do things like read me Shelley's poem, The Mask of Anarchy. It's a chaotic time. It's not a nodding of heads. It's feeling like your head is spun in all of the dilemmas.
Mm.
The collapse, we have complex institutions in our society, various different things related to technology and finance and what have you, but experts are not trusted. Experts, people with advanced degrees, people who can understand some of these scientific and other processes, are viewed as what you might call kowtowing to elites, and people have disregarded, they've lost trust or faith in governance, faith and expertise. And I think that, as you talked about, two crises, two chances of a lifetime. In the first one, because of the distributional ramifications, the need to get something done quickly so that we didn't collapse into a depression created an urgency, but that urgency existed within the context of a very damaged political economy where money plays too big a role in politics, what I call the commodification of social design implementation and enforcement. Who gets appointed? What laws are made? What regulations are enforced or not enforced is unfortunately quite heavily influenced by who are the donors to the political process. We have a money politics that has refracted representation away from a broad base to a narrow concentration of wealth, which you described in your opening remarks. That concentration of wealth is, it's like an amplifying feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
As wealth becomes more concentrated and that wealth is used to dominate politics, they can essentially subsidize themselves. They can make it legal. It used to be called tax evasion. Now it's just tax avoidance to keep your money offshore. And then many people who call themselves leaders talk about how we can't afford public school systems or this or that. Globalization, the onset of the challenge of bringing China into the world. And I grew up in Detroit, but I always say to people, God wasn't born in Detroit or Pittsburgh. The elevation of the living standards of the poorest regions in the world and of places moving up in the middle like China, India, Indonesia, Brazil is a good thing. But where it wasn't a good thing was that the gains from globalization, and the benefits that were earned by the mobility of capital, the mobility of technology, but not the mobility of labor, was used to lobby public policy to exacerbate the inequality, not to attenuate it.
Yeah, let me stop you for a second on that one, because I think that globalization was undertaken because there was both a rational and an economic explanation for it, a justification for it. But as you point out, it would have worked had the gains from making those moves been spread and included the people who were the losers in that move.
That's right. There's the old saying in economics, free trade can benefit, make everyone better off and nobody worse off. But there are mechanisms, which we'll call governance for shorthand, inside that process of transfers and retraining so that the transformation doesn't destroy large segments of the population's well-being or hope for the future. And that despair is part of what, along with financialization, along with the fears of automation, that's what that despair, what Angus Deaton and others call diseases of despair, is what fueled Donald Trump having an opportunity to become president of the United States. He could walk on the stage and say, the system is rigged. And you know what? That sounded like music to everyone's ears that were despairing.
And then he added, I alone can fix it, and they bought that as well.
Well, that might be called seduce and abandon.
Yeah.
Which led to his intensifying the use of what I'll call toxic identity politics,
mm-hmm,
to try to maintain the coalition of the people he had abandoned.
Yes, in other words, to maintain the coalition, though he didn't give them what he promised them. So then he had to hook their emotions even stronger to try to hold it together. I want to just comment on a couple of things you said. One, it's interesting when you said that when wealth generates a feedback loop and the accumulated wealth goes into changing the rules so that it becomes easier to accumulate and hold on to that wealth and harder for it to be spread around, that it's that feedback loop that becomes truly toxic. And I will tell you who made that point very explicit with me was Branko Milanović.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed him. He's one of the world, I'd say expert economists on inequality
earlier
this year. And that was one of the key sort of levers that he saw to both what was wrong and what needed to be attended to. Another thing you mentioned was that this wealth can change the rules and leaves people feel that their voice doesn't matter. Another study that I'm, I know you're fully cognizant of is the Martin Gillins at Princeton and Benjamin Page at Northwestern, who did the research. And here's the quote from their research: "A proposed policy change with low support among economically elite Americans is adopted about 18% of the time, while a proposed change with high support is adopted about 45% of the time. On the other hand, when a majority of regular citizens disagree with economic elites or organized interests, they generally lose." And the numbers are there that when the middle class wins, it's usually because that's something the elites happen to want as well. And when the elites win, it may have nothing to do with what the general citizenry wants.
Yes, but that's, in my opinion, that's a symptom of the money politics system, where I'm not making what you might call the allegation that our elected representatives are a discretionarily insensitive or immoral bunch of people. What I'm saying is, first you got to survive before you can do good policy. And the need to survive has become so dependent on money for campaign advertising and what have you, that they are what you might call put in a place. And by the way, where I would say they're culpable is that incumbents can sell policy, challengers can't. And so it's a bit of an insurance policy to make the system so reliant on money, because it gives what you might call an advantage to incumbents relative to their challengers, and therefore a disincentive to repair the representativeness of the system.
Mm-hmm. No, I appreciate that distinction, that once the system, and it's funny, I have often looked at it as people have said that American politics changed with the debates, the Nixon-Kennedy debates, and suddenly debates were on television and that changed everything. I think that changed something. But what I think changed everything was when television advertising became the sort of currency of political campaigns, which jacked up the price. All your union members going door to door, all those old tried and true coffee clutches and things, they didn't cost nearly anything. Someone could get into a race. Underdogs could compete. Once it shifted to these incredibly expensive ways of waging campaigns, that basically priced anyone who wasn't on the gravy train out of the business.
I once met former President Jimmy Carter, and we were talking about money and politics, and he said, "Yeah, I really held my breath because I needed to raise $30,000 to be able to get in the race in 1976.
In 76?
And now you're talking about over $1 billion to be a viable candidate. So I think that the scope and the scale of the influence of money. I started my, we might call legislative career, working for Pete Domenici as a senior economist on the Senate Budget Committee. And one night, I was talking with he and Bob Dole, who was at that time the majority leader on the floor. They were deliberating on budget. And Dole said to me, "Well, what would you do to help us trim the deficits?" And I said, "I would make sure that all media companies, television, radio, whatever, who get licenses to operate have to devote a significant proportion of time pro bono as public service, as public contribution to election, and I would have public, 100% public financing of elections. I think you would save so much money on what you might call log rolling and pork that people do in order to try to build their war chests to run the campaign, that the taxpayers would save $10 for every dollar they spent.
Interesting. And I'm sure something he didn't expect. In other words, he figured what budget item would you cut? But you realize that it's a bank shot, if you will, a billiards bank shot.
And what I thought was interesting was that Bob Dole did not dismiss what I said like I was some, you know, irritating young kid or what have you. I was in my 20s at the time. He said, oh, that's an interesting notion. But he was quite familiar. Even later in the same night, there was an amendment on that bill to allow banks to put their money offshore every day at 5 o'clock and bring it home in the morning so they didn't have to pay FDIC insurance. And Dole said, this is absurd. If they're paying for insurance, if they're going to get the insurance, they got to pay for it. They can't just whisk their money offshore and back on. He thought this was crazy, and he worked very hard to defeat that. So at that time, I felt in the Republican Party, there was still a sense of stewardship that he and Domenici, Howard Baker, McClure, Nancy Kassebaum Landon, John Danforth, and others embodied. But those people got primaried out by what you might call the raw money seekers, and the system has gotten much, much more toxically polluted. And as you said, now the television advertising and various other costs have skyrocketed and made aspiring officials much more dependent on money. I mean, people tell me it costs $50 million to run for Senate in many states now.
Yeah, it's crazy. Now, it turns out that one countervailing force is online fundraising and online donations.
Yes, that's right.
Doesn't change the sum you need, but it changes the people you appeal to or the people who can supply you with that huge amount of money.
Well, yeah, the technology of aggregation, the cost structure of aggregation has come way, way down, and the ability to reach those people and get a constellation of small donations was not feasible in years past, and it is now.
Yeah, and I mean, Bernie Sanders bragged, as have others, about the smallness of the average size of the contribution. I believe his was $27. And there are organizations, one of which I encourage people to look into, but there are others called Movement Voter Project, that instead of putting its money in big TV ads or expensive consultants, funds grassroots organizations on the ground in local areas to do their get out the vote, so that you are putting money in the hands then, smaller amounts, in the hands of people who are actually working for change, not just working within, there's a book came out just recently called The Politics Industry. In other words, I have been, as you, just feel that the foundational change is to change campaign finance. That almost any, as I said to people, must be for 30 years now, whatever your issue is, environment, women's rights, you know, you name it, labor rights, campaign finance is upstream of every one of those. And if it can be, but what I'm saying is that this new, as we were just talking about, this new possibility of raising it through smaller donations at least begins to undermine that. You said to me when I said maybe let's postpone, you said, and I'm not going to be any easier on the Democrats. Basically, what you're saying is that everything we're describing, let me preface that. We are not saying they are identical. We are not saying that Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton wouldn't have handled the pandemic differently, or that Donald Trump or Joe Biden wouldn't handle the pandemic differently, but to not be the same is not to say that the Democratic Party has been serving enough Americans to return to those days when the labor unions represented the working people, and the labor unions tended to be Democratic. We allowed mm-hmm. that to break, and when that broke, I don't believe the Democratic Party as a whole, there are exceptions, the Squad, Bernie, etc., but as a whole, it went the way of money.
Yeah, and as I mentioned with this amplifying feedback loop,
yes,
the use of policy exacerbated that and narrowed the number of people and large companies that have effective influence over our social design and implementation. And I think that further demoralized many people. And that is not something that's unique to the Republican Party. It's a systemic phenomenon that affects both sides.
Mm-hmm. You talk about, and you've mentioned it a couple of times so far today, a crisis of representation. Mm-hmm. And I don't have the feeling that a lot of people talk about representation, but I think you're talking about, and I'll let you talk about it, but it is, if you do not feel represented, you have no sense of ownership, you have no sense of belonging. And when those kinds of threads break, when that sort of fabric breaks, then things happen like what we've been describing so far, where you vote your desperation rather than your aspiration.
Right. What I would say, there's a gentleman you may be acquainted with, I've corresponded with, named Stuart Zechman. And in 2011, he was on a podcast where he described a senior Obama official who, how would I put this? The senior Obama official who refused to be disclosed by name said, "This is no longer like the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt. We can't refer to that because people don't trust in government." And Zechman, who was the guest, he's, I believe, was a musical artist at the time, but he was a guest on this podcast that day, had dug in to the Gallup polls about this notion that among progressives, they didn't trust the government. And the senior official was saying Obama can't do these more progressive policies because of that cynicism. And when you dug into the polls, what Zechman reported was the reason they didn't trust the government was they felt that the government had been captured and was working for what we'll call the plutocrats and the large corporations, not for the people. So they'd lost faith in what you might call the mechanism of governance to create balance. And I think that that has continued. And I think that the consulting revenues and other things that people inside the Beltway make has fed that process, the lobbying and what have you. And at this juncture, I think that the despair that people feel is not being answered. Let's just say, for instance, if in the 16 years prior to the nomination of Donald Trump, things happened that alienated people, made them despondent, and that becomes what you might call the history as co-author of why mm-hmm. Trump got the nomination.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of Trump's time, you run Joe Biden, who was the vice president in 8 of those 16 years, and a senior senator in the other 8. And you go to the convention, and I made a podcast of my own on economics and beyond with Rob Johnson, with Bob Borisaj, right after the Democratic convention. And what was his key point? They campaigned for 3 days on what a bad guy Trump was.
Yep.
They didn't say, we went to school, we went introspective, we learned what we didn't do right in those previous 8 years. And you've alluded to that about the nature of the bailouts and so forth that spawned the Tea Party and Occupy and turned the House Republican, the Senate Republican, and elected Donald Trump. And so now you have somebody who's what you might call symbolic of that era that produced Trump, berating Trump, but not talking about how he's gone introspective with his team, and they're going to do things differently. And that's what I think Bob Borisov was demoralized by, because that was, how would I say, you want to get people to cross over from that working class group that crossed over away from Obama to Trump. You want them to come back. But the other thing you want is the people who stayed home in places like Detroit, Michigan, that said, there's nothing on the menu I want to order from that restaurant called National Politics. And that part, the Democrats did not do a good job of inspiring. And I think many people right now, irrespective of the outcome, are quite terrified by how close this race is in the middle of a pandemic crisis at a time when, by all comparative standards, totally under control. Alex Gibney's new documentary illustrates, compared to South Korea, Donald Trump profoundly failed in the handling of the COVID crisis. It's much, much more pervasive. Many more people are dead. Many more people are sick. And he's talking about firing Fauci, as you said at the outset. But when people say there isn't an alternative that inspires me, they may still not get out of bed and vote. And this election is much closer than I thought it ever would, in my wildest dreams, that I thought it ever would be.
Absolutely. I felt, I was shocked that Trump won in 2016. But once I got over my shock, I said, well, you know, at its very simplest, the right had been building a case against Hillary Clinton for 30 years. She had been demonized, and Trump offered, as I recall, to me, the most crucial moment in any of the debates was in the final debate, we're going back to 2016, between Trump and Hillary. And he didn't pull it quite as much with Biden this time around, though he could have, when he just repeated about three or four times, you've been in Washington for 30 years, it hasn't changed. You've been in, and I, as I say, he didn't pull that nearly as much with Biden as I think he could have, because to me, that is Trump's argument. Now, it gets harder to do when you've been president for 3 years and nothing's changed, you know, so on. But that damnation of you haven't responded. And as you say, had the Democrats done that examination, now, there are certainly people within the Democratic Party that are either doing that examination or are the result of that examination. AOC, the Squad, Bernie, etc. Mm-hmm. There's people who know that the problem is that it isn't just that we haven't done the things that excite voters. It's we haven't done the things that heal our nation. You know, it's those 4 years between the elections that we're not making America what it could be, because we do just enough to be different than the other side, maybe. If I'm not mistaken, going back to what you said of trying to pull people who used to maybe vote Democratic back, you say, I'm not in favor of the Green New Deal if you're Biden. You say, I'm not in favor of Medicare for all. More again than you say what you are for.
Yeah. And what you do is you play a game called least worst by a sliver. In other words, both sides are competing for the money politics, which is that distorted and refracted representation. It's that crisis. But what you want to do is signal that you're a little better
yep.
than they are, but not a heck of a lot. For instance, many have said, why, with all the concerns about finance and extravagance, and particularly after Donald Trump appeared to use the trillions of bailout money to support assets rather than people and jobs, why didn't Joe Biden say, Elizabeth Warren will be my Treasury Secretary, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Congressional Oversight Committee of TARP? She's sophisticated and she's shown a very different vision of what to do with finance. And the answer you get when you hear the inside the baseball whispers is, Well, then it would chase all the fundraising over to the Republican side. Elizabeth would have taken all the Wall Street people off of Biden's team and chased them over. Well, so both sides are quite constrained about what they can do to serve a broad base of the public. And I think that the population is quite cynically sensitive to the failures of representation being a systemic problem, not a question of this personality or that personality. And what's a little bit awkward is that the person who kind of stepped out of the ranks and he telegraphed that the system was rigged was Donald Trump. I remember listening to a guy on the radio, his name's Scott Adams. He lives in Berkeley, California, and he said—
Is that the Dilbert guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I interviewed him too, yeah.
and he was talking about how he had taken courses with Steve Jobs on like all kinds of the psychology of persuasion, and this man named Pierre Clement about hypnosis and what you might call just techniques of communication. And he said in this podcast, this guy Trump is amazing. He's really clearly like worked with people like Tony Robbins or Milton Erickson or all these kind of people that work in that realm. So I tuned into a debate, 2015. It's in Florida. And I see Jeb Bush, who was the governor of Florida previously, starts to berate Trump. And everybody cheers. And then Trump goes back and berates him and everybody boos. And so what did Trump do? He turns to the TV camera and he says, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm paraphrasing, we're here at an event held by the Republican National Committee. And the people who are cheering for former Governor Bush is not just because we're here in Florida. It's because they're the donors. They're the people who are stifling you. And I sat there and I said, wow, this guy really is going to be viable because he might get crushed by the establishment. But he's turning to the cameras and saying everything inside the room is corrupt. And that was in large part what a lot of people were feeling.
Yeah.
Now, and they were feeling that about the Clinton Foundation and all kinds of various different ways in which they were pulling money together. And the cynicism, even among sophisticated people like members of the board of INET and other things, people who are not anti-establishment, people who are, you know, famous in the world of hedge fund or banking or technology or whatever, they were all talking about the deep systemic corruption. Paul Volcker was talking to me about that. God bless him and rest in peace. But Paul Volcker was talking to me about the unbridled corruption on both sides of the aisle.
Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally, speaking with Rob Johnson, Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, INET. And you can learn more at ineteconomics.org. That's I-N-E-T, economics.org. Let's shift a little bit to, I often think about interviews in terms of it's broke, let's fix it. Three questions. What's the evidence that it's broken? And I think we've laid out plenty of that. And by it, in this case, I think I mean the role of government, the role of politics, the two parties, etc. What's the evidence that it's broken? How did it get broken? We've talked about that. It's the cost of campaigns. It's the feedback loops that make you can start from that, and then everything else can unfold from that if you have the feedback loops in place where money begets rules and rules beget money. And then how do we fix it? So when you think about how we fix it, it seems to me that question has a number of levels, but the first two that occur to me is what sort of changes need to be made, Okay, like one could change campaign finance, one could change taxes on speculation, one could change the way we do college loans, one could change expand universal health care, etc. But then the other question is, how do we make those changes happen? What's the process, the mechanisms that could make those things possible? What are some of your thoughts about a change and a path to that change?
Yeah. Well, you articulated a number of the necessary change, and I would say an embracing of a transformation of the energy system also ranks very high.
Oh, my regard. God, yes. Yes, I left that out.
I would say a much broader-based higher floor on American healthcare and on the education through the public schools to create what you might call credible notion of opportunity, which involves both health and learning. I think the other things that come to mind are the very expensive and very dysfunctional prison industrial system.
Mm.
I do not believe, let's say someone does something wrong, and in a society that supposedly has spiritual or religious values, the notion of redemption, the notion of someone getting back on track, in prison, being given opportunity to be educated, to be trained, so that when their term is up, they can come out and do something productive and self-satisfying in civil society and not go back to jail. I think we're missing tremendous opportunities in that regard. I am concerned, particularly with concern for safety, that the weaponization of our law enforcement system, a byproduct of the weapons created for wars like Afghanistan and Iraq and the way people are trained.
The militarization,
The militarization, yeah. Yes. It's but it's also a psychological thing.
Yes, it is.
Because when you go to a foreign country in a war, those people are called enemies, even though they're humans. Here, these are your citizens. They're the people you're supposed to be protecting. And the militarization seems to be accompanied by what you might call a demonization,
yes,
particularly as it pertains to race. And I think that we've got to re-examine. I mean, even I've seen evidence that people like the Koch brothers are concerned about the cost of the prison system and the inhumanity of it. It's not just a left or a right thing. I've seen what you might call strange bedfellows,
uh-huh,
in supporting such a thing. But I can talk about all of these policies, but if we allow the commodification of social design through money and politics, all of these policies will be off course. Now, the question that you asked, which is the bigger question, how are you going to change that? My own sense right now is that we are at the cusp with the pandemic after the murder of George Floyd, with concerns about law enforcement and prisons, with all kinds of social distress and social activism, that even elites, even the people who can live in a gated community, are becoming scared about the stability of our society. Some may even say that the advent of someone like Donald Trump as a president reflects a despair and threatens the fabric of democracy. And so what I guess I would say is that young people need to continue this rising trend of activism. And I would hope that what you may call stewardship-minded, frightened, more senior people, wealthy people, would understand that we are not on a sustainable trajectory and their lives can be harmed too. I mean, there are a lot of wealthy people who've gotten the COVID virus.
Exactly.
Not in proportion
right.
to their numbers, but the kind of things that are malfunctioning in our society now can bring down all of our lives, not just a small segment, disproportionately that smaller segment, but everybody's at risk now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I believe that though with the inequities we see, that the shared vulnerability to something like the virus, shared across your city, across your state, across your country, across the globe, I think it gets through to people. And I think, by the way, that we were in a state of shared vulnerability when, with the aid of a 17-year-old's phone and video, we were all witnesses to George Floyd's murder. That right. two things came together, three things. One, the act happened. But two, we were in a vulnerable state and a shared vulnerable state, and we were witnesses. And I think that is why we had the demonstrations we had, was that all those things came together. Can I tell you that as you were saying those last few things, two of the subjects I was hoping to touch on with you before the end of the hour, both came up for me. One is you said that young people keep acting, keep fighting, keep moving. I have been thinking about for a few years something I call 60s 2.0, which is that the young people hold a lot of the same values that motivated the best of the 60s. You know, the 60s had was a mixed era, but I'm talking about the best, which was, you know, civil rights and anti-war and community and you know, a lot of nature, all of those things. But that there are some things I think that give those values a better chance today. One is that there's technology that makes it easier to organize and easier to not feel alone. Mm-hmm. Second, that in the 60s, there was much less of a talent pool to pull from. Almost every leader, you look at the Chicago 8 movie, and mm-hmm. it's all male. And it's 8 white males and a black male. And mm-hmm. all the leaders back then pretty much were. And now I think I point just to the most opposite thing you could see, which is Greta Thunberg.
Yes.
A Scandinavian teenager is a movement leader, and that we now have LGBTQ, Asian, Latino, Black. There's just this range of talent to pull from. And third, that we were basically alone, except for, you know, a few beatniks in San Francisco and Greenwich Village. And that now, if these generations, our generation and the generations in between and the young people can come together, that there's a chance that real change could happen. Does that resonate with you at all?
Yeah. And I think, let me bring up two elements of 60s 2.0. First is I would encourage you to have as a guest Edward P. Morgan,
oh.
who wrote a book called What Really Happened in the 60s. He's a professor in Pennsylvania. And the book is fantastic. And
great.
Mark Crispin Miller and he made a beautiful video together that's on YouTube about his perspective. And it's about how the refractory nature of a private sector media worked with what I'll call conservative or counter forces to the 60s movement to demonize it and denigrate it. And I think Edward's illuminating that process is just really artful. The second is I just recently finished making some videos with Daniel Ellsberg,
uh-huh.
the man who put forward the Pentagon Papers. In his most recent book, which is called The Doomsday Machine,
yep.
is about how risky the command and control system is over the control and firing of nuclear weapons, and how the scale of missile stocks on both sides, even though the Cold War is allegedly over, could incinerate what they call the upper atmosphere. and lead to what's called a nuclear winter. And these are not pipe dreams. This is stuff that's been published in Nature, Science, and other places. And I think a disarmament movement to avoid a nuclear winter, which Ellsberg claims would kill more than 6 billion out of the 7 billion people. Not from when the bombs go off.
No, no. It's from what happens
from the introduction of an ice age for 12 or 15 years that would destroy crops and animals and sources of food on planet Earth. And I think that Daniel is very thoughtful, and I think that that should be on the agenda. It's as urgent and it's as potent and dangerous as climate change.
Yeah.
And I think that the pressure, as you said, with this technology, it can be organized, but also with this technology, one might say it can be surveilled. And we've got to bring our technological systems into balance as they become very, very few and large-scale monopolies.
When I expand on what I just said to you, yes, the caveat for the value, the positive value of internet and technologies like that is the surveillance capitalism, which isn't just about facial recognition and that sort of thing, but about the distortions and amplification of distortions and the misinformation echo chambers that we know are at play. The QAnon conspiracy is definitely a product going from some minute fringe to there are going to be people in Congress that hold on to it. That is a social media phenomenon. And I think surveillance capitalism is something we've really got to get a handle on. And it's one of those things, perhaps like nuclear war, that government doesn't feel is not technologically able to grasp and thus regulate, you know, well enough.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Thank you for those two things. The other one I was going to mention goes in hand, and it was when you said stewardship. Here's my question. It appears to me that authoritarianism has real advantages when confronting big problems that call for rapid pivots and rapid and large mobilization. Okay, what FDR could do in World War II in transforming our economy quickly and mobilizing, China does every day. Have we been such poor stewards of democracy, with money dominating politics, an inability to solve problems or promote the general welfare a great deal because of that, that China will lead the world's response to climate change and possibly the pandemic as well, and thus the saving of this planet by authoritarianism rather than democracy, and what that means for the future of society?
Yeah. Well, I think those are very real concerns. You know, people talk about freedom, and my sense of freedom is that it has something, and I'm thinking now of gun control and the pandemic. With regard to freedom, part of freedom is having the right to do what you want to do. But part of freedom is having the right to be protected from the intrusion and side effects of other people's actions.
Yeah.
And we don't, in the realm of gun control or in the realm of pandemic discipline, seem to have found the balance, and I think to the detriment of the integrity of our society. Watching these militarized protest groups on New York Times videos the last couple of days is really haunting. I mean, it's one thing to defend free speech for people on both sides. It's another thing to let them carry AK-47s while intimidating people on the other side. So I think an authoritarian system runs the risk of not being responsive, becoming a intimidating, violent oligarchy. We've seen that in history. So I don't know that it's an answer. But I also sense, I do a lot of work in China over the years, going back to the late 1980s, is that there is an awareness among Chinese educated elite in the government that social instability is like a contagion, and it tends to bring down empires and governments throughout their history. And being responsive in design and in implementation is something they're every bit as sensitive to or more than a lot of people in the West. But I guess in the U.S.-China comparison, where I'm concerned, and I've done conferences on this and a lot of work in recent months, is the role of China versus the United States in the development of the African continent, mm-hmm. where if you look at the next 50 years of demographic profiles, the rise of the working age population from about 1.2 billion to 2.6 billion people in Africa is going to be enormous. It's a development challenge in the context of climate change, automation, machine learning, where we don't have a development strategy, and obviously the fears of wide-scale migration are already quite profound mm-hmm. in parts of Europe. And yet, when I watch the Chinese, I mean, it looks a little bit like the old Argentine situation where the British built the railroads and then controlled the distribution and suppressed the profits of the people within the country. The Chinese are building ports, they're building railroads, they're building things, but at least they're contributing to development. In the United States, it looks more like gunpoint and coercive finance. And I am concerned about the example of the American way or the American way of being and the notion of freedom that we offer deteriorating, though I'm not necessarily of the mind that the Chinese offer a vastly superior model by any means.
No, and I've got to bring this to a close, but I didn't mean a better model. I just mean that able to, because it really comes down to this notion that we have not been stewards of
democracy.
We don't solve problems because the lobbyist is in the way and the payoff is here. And it isn't like you put the problem out there and now you say, and this is how we solve it and this is what it takes. It has to go through all these filters of garbage, basically, you know, so that the money gets what they want versus solving the problem. And that by becoming laxer and laxer in terms of democracy being able to solve problems, it cedes the game to authoritarianism, which doesn't have to put up with quite as much of that stuff when it makes a decision. The reason I reached out to you following the election was because I knew we will cover a lot of territory and we will think about it a little, or we will consider it a little more deeply than many other folks I might talk to at this time. It's always a pleasure, Rob Johnson. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I want to put out a little bit of a flag for a man named Fred Ledley, who's done some beautiful work on how the public pays for the science behind new drugs, but then the private equity and pharma companies get to charge what they want to the public. And that realm on the cusp of the pandemic is very demoralizing. And Fred Ledley and his co-authors, Matt Jackson and Ekaterina Clary, have done a beautiful job in, as you dig down into the different tributaries mm-hmm. of change that is needed, I'd be happy to talk with you about the people who I think are illuminating the challenges.
Oh, most absolutely. Vigorously. Yes. In other words, that part that we got to at the end, which is what are the changes that are needed and what are the pathways we can take?
Right.
That would be a great conversation. So again, Rob is Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, and you can learn more at ineteconomics.org. That's I-N-E-T economics.org. For this conversation and many others, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or A World That Just Might Work.com, all one word. They're the same website. And if you want to receive my weekly email announcement where I tell you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and I give you 8 to 10 articles that I think are really timely and relevant, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and most podcast sites. You can find archives, and the archives are searchable at my site. They're not usually searchable on the podcast sites, but Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, on and on. Thank you to G in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Rob Johnson. Keep up the good work.
Well, the pleasure is mine. Thank you.